As I looked out my window at the clear blue sky, at the planes that flew so low, at the smoke that rose so high, the air filled up with dust that blackened out the sun, and the politicians went on about the new day that had begun. And when I looked at my calendar, I knew it would be so. It was on this day in Santiago. Less than 30 years had passed, and how clearly I remember what the city had been like before that day in September. There were doctors on the sidewalks helping those in need, students in the barrios teaching children how to read. There were milk trucks in the shanties driving to and fro. On this day in Santiago, I could tell you about the rallies, the whole city in the street. The president was speaking and we all were on our feet. Allende was the future, destitution was the past. The city was in motion and things were changing fast. Just how fast they were changing, only Kissinger could know. On this day in Santiago, Anaconda Copper and Nixon got their dream. A country torn apart, ruptured at the seam. A fascist coup was what they wanted, and that's just what they'd get when they sent down from Fort Benning General Pinochet. Lady Liberty hung her head down low on this day in Santiago. They dropped bombs on La Moneda with jet planes from D.C. They killed 5,000 people in our city by the sea. A reign of terror started when they cut off Victor's hands. The rivers clogged with bodies and our blood drenched the sands. And I remember wondering which way future winds might blow on this day in Santiago.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this broadcast, we're listening to Elizabeth Warren talk about fixing the banks and lifting the middle class.
2003, I wrote The Two Income Trap. 2004, I wrote a book on financial advice, All You're Worth. I was starting to do blogs about the coming crisis, the collapse, what was going to happen. And I thought, you know, this is no good. My only tool, I really felt this way about it. I felt like someone who raged at the wind. And I thought, this is crazy. If I'm going to expend this much energy, I need to find a way to make it have a difference. Yelling is not working here. So back up and find something else to do. And I came up with an idea. God, I thought this was a good idea. Not the agency. It's something else. It was called Clean Cards. Isn't that a cool name? So what Clean Cards was about, here was the idea behind it. My theory was, we'd start with credit cards. It was the most obvious place. It was the product people were using on a regular basis. You didn't have to wait to caught people happen to be buying homes. You didn't have all the complications. I thought, this will be the tip on the spear and the way to think about this. And what we'll do with Clean Cards is we'll set up a group that will be sort of the people of integrity, people who might be recognizable to other people, who will say collectively, we will certify that this is a clean credit card. And here's what clean credit card means. It's like a good housekeeping seal of approval or underwriter's laboratory. Long before this was done in government, right? The idea that someone would say, we looked at this and it's safe. And here's all I was looking for safe, is that the costs and risks were clear up front. There was no icky, creepy stuff hidden in the fine print. That was basically all you had to commit to. You could charge whatever you wanted and get a clean card if you would simply do upfront pricing where somebody could see it. You made the price clear in advance and then agreed that you wouldn't put junk in the back and we would read it to make sure you didn't put junk in the back. And so as long as you were holding the clean card designation on your credit card, you could go ahead and you charge anything you want. So I talked to some various folks about this. Pew Charitable Trust said they thought this was a great idea, and they put up a lot of money that was well spent. And here's how it was well spent. This is true. They hired one of the fanciest bank consulting companies, basically to sit down with me and a few other folks they got together to walk through how credit card profitability worked, walk through the terms, walk through what had been put in, how they changed, showing us the competitiveness of the industry and so on, so that we could frame it right. And this really was, you know, getting to go back to college, right? Going to college on credit cards 101 on someone else's nickel. So we got this all together, and they hired someone who was very well respected, who'd recently retired from the industry, who's now in the witness protection program. And we went out and we paid calls on, all I can say is, thanks to the confidentiality agreements, on executives and companies whose names you would recognize. So we go out, and I want to tell you how these went. We had exactly the same experience repeated. So the first one would be we'd show up and kind of explain clean cards. And listen, competitive industry. Everybody wanted those credit card customers. Understand that. It was competitive in the sense that they were desperate to get you to use their card instead of someone else's card because they figured out how to make these cards so incredibly profitable on the back end. So I learned things like, you know, getting it to top of wallet and cross-selling and all these things. So getting customers in, enormously valuable to these companies. So we said, in effect, you can have the clean card seal to put on your card. And think of it this way. You'll be the one. You'll be America's finest bank. Your CEO will have his, and they were always his, picture up on the cover of Business Week at a minimum, Newsweek if you're lucky. And you could see them. This was cool, right? So people were, how this might work, we might have to take a little trim here and blah, blah, blah. So it worked. We get invited back for the second one, and we've moved up the food chain to fancier people at the company. Second visit goes very well. They actually generally served refreshments. I measure by these things. And people are getting enthusiastic. They're asking more details. Well, could we still keep our brass knuckles? Yeah, you could still keep your brass knuckles. You know, and we'd have back, could we still do that? Well, I'm not sure you could do that. So we'd talk back and forth about what you could and couldn't do. I mean, they're starting to get serious, at least about the basic outline of how this thing works. Some real enthusiasm. We want to talk to you. Go back for the third visit. And the third visit, no refreshments, was always, we're not interested. We're not going to do this. And I was walking out with a guy who put his arm around my shoulder. And he said, you know, he said, I get that what we're doing is unsustainable over the long haul. We can't keep this up. Americans can't keep borrowing more money. But he said, your clean cards isn't going to work. And I said, why not? You know, it'll have some advantage. This drives a market. You get some competition out there. You identify the good guys. And he said, you've got to understand, if we had to tell them how much these things cost, nobody would use them. And I sat on the plane on the way back, and I thought, it's true. No one can jump in a market in which the game is all about pretend to give it away for free, knowing you're going to hit them on the back end. Nobody can be the first one to say, this thing actually costs 17%, and put that right up front. And no matter how many other good people say, at least kudos to you, you explained how much it costs. They're not going to pick up any business when everybody else is doing it at 2.9%, or so it seems on the front end. And lest that lesson not be driven home hard enough for me, I'll just tell you two quick stories in succession. The first one was when we were debating the Card Act back and forth about 3 or 4 years ago. There was a big issue back and forth about universal default. And that was something that was ultimately outlawed in the Card Act. Universal default just says if you get into trouble on anything, the credit card company can raise your fees, even if you've been making those payments on time in full under your contract. And a lot of people thought that was fundamentally unfair. So there's a lot of bad press around it. One very large credit issuer stood up and made a huge public declaration. We hereby renounce universal default. And Congress people stood up with executives from that card company and said, this is the way it should go. This is the market repairing itself. This shows you that markets can discipline themselves, that markets can heal themselves. Great. You couldn't ask for more press around it. It was more than I was ever going to be able to give with clean cards. What happened? Within a matter of months, that same company had to push some poor, hapless vice president out the door to announce as quietly as humanly possible the company has resumed using universal default. And the interesting part about the why is the explanation that followed. This is a paraphrase, but what it basically said is these damn things have become so complicated that when we made ours a little bit cleaner, nobody could tell the difference. So all we're doing is just giving up revenue. A competitive market causes us to continue to issue the dirtiest possible product. So I figure we got to do something else.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the finest hotel in all of Cuba. Come on down. We'll leave the searchlight on for you. If you're under arrest with no charges to confess, come where the setting's great and made to captivate. You won't mind the wait. Though you'll get no trial date, you'll be getting a tan like you couldn't in Afghanistan. Here at Guantanamo,
there's breakfast, burritos, we can swim in Speedos. They let us play Yahtzee, Durbin calls them Nazis. There's trips to Bahamas, if you find
some Osama. Some people say it's cruel, I know. Call it the gulag, but it isn't so. It's nicer than Buffalo. Here at Guantanamo,
while you're detained, they might just pick your brain.
With a view so great,
so great,
and lots of time to ululate, you'll forget the urgency of the insurgency. Daiquiris so tall,
so tall,
rimmed with sodium pentothal, freeze your throat, you cannot yell death to the infidel. Down at Guantanamo,
where's Lindy? We miss her. And games of naked twister, nice sunsets and beaches, if you don't mind leashes and songs on your iPods. Go nicely with your
shihas. We guarantee Guantanamo is safer than another place we know, standing a phone's throw away from Russell Crowe.
And now back to Elizabeth Warren.
And that means that something else we got to do, my suggestion was that we go to the consumer agency. The idea here is that you've got one agency in Washington that's really just pushing for a kind of basic principle, and that is that the same set of rules apply to all issuers who issue a particular consumer credit product, and you get them all in one place. So that means if you've got a mortgage, the rules are going to be the same. If you've got to take out a mortgage, the rules governing that mortgage will be the same, whether it was issued by a state-chartered bank, a federally chartered bank, or no bank at all, a mortgage broker. It's going to be the same in terms of the kind of disclosure we do, whether you're borrowing money on a credit card, whether you're doing it by a check overdraft, whether you're doing it by payday lending. If you're borrowing money, there ought to be some similarity in terms of the information that's given to the borrower and some comparability so that people can understand the price, understand the risk, and be able to compare those products and figure out which ones are cheaper, which ones are more dangerous, and which ones they want to do business with. So what this is really about is this new agency is to say, I actually still believe in markets. I do believe in markets. But I believe that the role of government is very important. The role of government in markets is to make sure that the competition is the visible competition, the competition that's out front. In other words, make the price clear, make the risk clear, make it so the products are easy enough to compare one to another, and then knock yourself out on competition. Do it on price. Do it on customer service. We are the bank where you can reach a live human being. Do it on services. Do it on cool iPhone apps. The point is, move competition not into the back. What's one more trick you can hide in the shrubbery, which is where competition was, to what is it that will attract consumers and add value for them? Because it is the role of government to make sure the competition is not occurring back in the hidden spaces. So what are we going to do with this agency? What are we planning to do here? Basic principle: make the price clear, make the risk clear, make it easy to compare products. And when I say clear, I mean real clarity. I do not mean a giant Where's Waldo puzzle. I mean simple, easy to read, straightforward terms. Make this competition work for families, not against them. So that's the first part of the insight about what this agency is about and about what role government should play in markets. It should push markets in the direction of saying compete. You know, I know, I've used the toaster analogy once or twice before, but it really is worth noting here on appliances, on drugs, on any other thing that we taste, feel, touch, smell, the parts that are hidden, the wiring down in the toaster, the safety switches, what the quality of the wire is and the likelihood it will burst into flames, that's the part the government watches out for you. That's the part where, as a people, we engage collectively and say, yeah, we're going to designate somebody, the government, to make sure that everybody's following the same set of rules on that stuff. That nobody figured out, let's boost the profits by taking out the safety switches. Nobody said, let's boost the profits by using the cheaper wiring that's going to burst into flames. And then, where does competition go? Just like it has with toasters. You know, you can get orange ones, you can get silver ones, you can get ones that, you know, do lots of pieces, you can get ones that only do two pieces, you can get high-priced ones, you can get low-priced ones. Competition works, but it works against a background that makes sure that we are safe in that sense. So that's the first part, but I want to say a second part about the role of government because it's become so clear to me as we've worked through this idea of an agency. Rules are not enough. They need careful and consistent enforcement. So I want to give you a small piece of this is to remind you, we have seven federal agencies who have a piece of the consumer credit market. For none of those agencies is the consumer the primary focus or primary responsibility. It's always the redheaded stepchild at the picnic. Nobody actually wants to claim it. People talk about, we're going to do a little consumer, but the truth is, we're here to watch out for the profitability of the banks. We're here to watch out for monetary policy. We are not here to watch out for consumers. And so one of the central parts of what this consumer agency does is it not only talks about the same treatment between banks and non-banks, it also talks about the same treatment by pulling it out of seven different agencies and putting it in one agency that actually cares about this and that is directly accountable to the American people for it. I think this is a really critical part of what happens in building, what we will be doing by building a consumer agency. It's that we actually get an enforcement force whose central issue is how do these products look from the point of view of the consumer? What are the rules? And if the rules aren't being followed, to come in and provide some real enforcement on that. We need a real commitment to consumer protection. It can't be half-hearted. Banks cannot be in a position, I don't know if you all knew this, to pick their own regulators, which has been the system up to now. And that the regulators, among the banking regulators, the OTS and the OCC, they get their budgets based on how many banks choose them. Ask yourself why consumer protection was not at the top of their list over the last couple of decades. That was the structure. So part of what I'm trying to say about this, let me do one more. The notion of what fragmented oversight means from another direction, and that is, think about this mortgage servicing scandal that we have just gone through. You know, as scandals go, this was like the dumbest scandal out there, right? This was not a Ponzi scheme where somebody said, we're going to pay you from the profits. And, you know, somebody could look at it and say, well, it kind of looked okay up until somebody did the accounting and dug into the books. Much of this is there were companies that just decided it was cheaper not to follow the law. And they didn't follow the law. This is not, we needed fancier laws. This was not, if you dug deeper, you would have seen it. They did not follow the law. 4 years ago, there were academics, you are looking at one of them, who were talking about the fact that there were troubles in mortgage servicing. They were not following the rules before you foreclose. Katie Porter, one of my former students, of whom I am very proud, got interested in this whole question and did a big study on it. She used the bankruptcy data, and bankruptcy data are fabulous. She could look at all kinds of things. And discovered, kind of through that lens, that mortgage servicers just weren't filing and creating the basic paperwork that they were supposed to create in terms of showing the chain of title, showing who owed, you know, just kind of checking off the boxes on this. There were people who were waving their arms about this, and yet not one agency in Washington that gave anyone the time of day that had the slightest interest in it until the problem got bigger and bigger and bigger, finally hit the front pages, it's everywhere, and again, threatens the entire system, starts to rock the entire system before we could catch anyone's attention on it. When there's fragmented oversight, when everybody's supposed to be watching a little bit, nobody's really watching. And I think that's part of what broke in this financial system, and that's part of what we are going to fix with the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So I'm going to stop there. I could talk about this bureau all night long. I could. And I could do it for the same reasons that Joanne Alter could talk all night long. We believe in making changes. In my case, I'm going to keep driving for an agency, driving for an informed consumer, driving for someone who is going to say, no matter how powerful the institution, or not powerful, how much it figures out how to hide on a corner and nobody can find it, or on the internet, all the different tricks. No, this is not going to work anymore. We're going to make these markets work better and make them work better for families. We are not going to have a repeat of the most recent financial crisis, at least in the division of bringing down the American families. We are not going to do this anymore. We are going to wind down the financial stress on middle-class America. America's middle class is in deep peril. I chose public service at this moment because I believe that Americans deserve better. We deserve a financial system that works, not one that's stacked against hardworking families and that puts so much risk into the larger economy. We need rules that work for all of us. The recent financial crisis was a reckoning, a profound moral testing. Our security as a country rests on whether we can design a suitable set of laws that work, not just for the powerful few, but for all of us. Whenever our country has faced economic reckonings in the past, government has played a vital role in course-correcting actions, providing a way forward that serves the common good, one that gives us our national identity and that makes us stronger collectively. Women have historically provided key guidance at these junctures, with Joanne Alter representing an inspiring example. Women are needed now more than ever. With the new Consumer Bureau, we have a chance to make an enduring and significant contribution. So I follow Joanne in saying, I'm ready to do my part.
Driving down the highway where I spent half my life, when I saw another scene that always cuts me like a knife. Some flowers, wreaths, and crosses laid out for the deceased, and a note from his pretty girlfriend saying, Clay, rest in peace. He won't be playing football now, nobody will keep score, and next year there will be 60,000 more. He had just looked down for a moment to find something he had lost, never guessing that that moment would have such a cost. The road ahead was curving, and the sun was on the rise, right above the tree line, it caught him in the eyes. Right here in America, you wanna know what lies in store? Next year, there will be 60,000 more. His dad was washing dishes in the kitchen all alone when he heard the ringing. And he picked up the phone, it was a policeman. He said, I have some awful news. I'll see you at the funeral. I'll be with you in the pews. He hung up the telephone and crumpled to the floor. And next year, there will be 60,000 more. It's the world that we live in, all covered up with tar, spending half our lives behind the wheel of a car. So roll your dice, America, and gamble on your fate. You can start the engine, but you can't pick the date. It's not a plague, it's not a famine, and they say it's not a war. But next year, there will be 60,000 more.
Now, messages from Access Sacramento.